make no campaign promises. Because until a few weeks ago, I had no hope of being elected. Now, however, I have something more than a hope. And Jim Geddes has something less than a chance. Every straw vote, every independent poll shows that I'll be elected.
That's a clip from what is often considered to be the greatest movie ever made, Orson Welles' 1941 classic, Citizen Kane. The actor Simon Callow writes about the making of Citizen Kane and Welles' career after Kane in the second volume of his Orson Welles biography, Orson Welles Volume 2, Hello Americans. Simon Callow talked to Steve Paulson about Welles' career.
Certainly something went terribly wrong after Citizen Kane for Welles in Hollywood, because within 18 months of the release of that film, and Welles being acclaimed as the greatest living filmmaker, he only having made one film, and Kane being regarded as the absolute climax of cinematic art, he was unemployable in Hollywood.
So that view was present back then. I mean, because, of course, in recent decades, Citizen Kane is routinely rated the greatest film ever made. But that critical assessment was also there right after Citizen Kane came out?
Absolutely. There was almost complete unanimity in the acclaim it received. And, you know, of course, it had been delayed. Its release had been delayed while William Randolph Hearst and his cohorts tried to suppress it. But during that time, RKO very smartly showed the film to many journalists. And even before its release, they were telling us that it was the greatest movie that had ever been made, the sum of celluloid art so far. Of course, that made an impact on audiences in New York and in Los Angeles, but pretty well nowhere else in the country. And it was a catastrophic failure at the box office. Hmm. It was, in fact, known as box office poison, literally. I mean, audiences didn't just not go. When they went, they detested it, which is very understandable in a way because, you know, the whole point about Citizen Kane is that it's a film which keeps reminding you that it's a film. And that's exactly what audiences of the time didn't like. What they liked was the illusion of real life. That was supposed to be the beauty of cinema, was that it filmed real life, do you know?
Well, and the other piece of it is that Kane, the character Orson Welles plays, is not especially likable. So, I mean, no. Just in purely movie-going terms, it's in some ways, it's a hard film to like.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think what's very striking about Citizen Kane is that it's the film that has made more people want to become filmmakers than any other, because you can sense Welles's joy in discovering the medium. That's the glory of Citizen Kane. I mean, I'm not decrying the content. There's certainly a very powerful theme there and a powerful message, so to speak. But what, above all, is the message is the medium. Everybody feels, when they've seen Kane, oh, fantastic, Orson, you think, that's a wonderful shot. God, what a great idea, don't you? I mean,
absolutely.
You don't submit, as it were, to the story being told. You're always aware of the storyteller.
Yeah. Now, the common view is that Orson Welles was crushed by Hollywood. The studios just could not handle his brashness and his genius. He was too big for Hollywood, and they had to cut him down to size. How accurate is that story?
Well, it's complex. Certainly, there was a fact at RKO and in Hollywood in general that longed for Welles's comeuppance. You know, he enraged a lot of the film community just by being there, really, by being this person from the theatre who had come to Hollywood, made all kinds of public statements about what Hollywood should be and shouldn't be, and then infuriatingly had made this film, which was in fact wonderful. Even his enemies tended to agree it was a wonderful movie. But within RKO, of course, there was a tremendously strong faction which simply said, look at the balance sheet. We can't afford this man. And RKO was in trouble anyway. However, to look at it from the other perspective, it is absolutely true that Welles did nothing at all, not only to ingratiate himself with Hollywood, but he did nothing at all to make sure that he was fully cooperating with his own supporters. And the most important of his supporters was the head of RKO Studio, who was a man called George Schaefer. And it was George Schaefer who'd brought Welles to Hollywood, George Schaefer who'd given him that extraordinary contract, George Schaefer who fought almost within an inch of his professional life for Citizen Kane, which, as everybody probably knows, a lot of people wanted to actually destroy, not merely to prevent it from being released, but actually to destroy the physical film. And George Schaefer fought for Welles. So you would have thought Welles would have seen that he had a real supporter and collaborator in Schaefer, but he never treated him as such. And when Schaefer begged him, for example, to return from Brazil, where he was making a film called It's All True, to complete work on The Magnificent Amazons, Welles more or less ignored him. Hmm. Now, that's so, just not sensible behavior.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a competing story that Welles was inherently self-destructive. He set himself up for failure. And, I mean, going back to his second movie, The Magnificent Ambersons, I mean, a lot of people were thinking, oh, my God, if he could do that with Citizen Kane, this is going to be his true masterpiece, yeah. The Magnificent Ambersons. And then he finishes shooting. He goes off to Brazil on some rather strange mission. We can talk about that later, while the final cut is being made. And it's essentially destroyed by the studios.
Well, this is the point. You're absolutely right. But the point is that Citizen Kane is what it is, as much because of what happened in post-production, after the film had been shot, as for what it was when it was being shot. I mean, it's a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant piece of shooting by Greg Toland, brilliantly lit, brilliantly staged, etc. But what gives it its extraordinary tone in the end was done in post-production. And you would have thought Welles would think, oh, right, that's, you know, that's a good lesson. I must make sure that I have a lot of time for post-production for The Magnificent Ambersons. But in fact, he more or less felt that having shot it, he'd finished it, which is a strange mistake for him to have made. Then he went to Brazil, and he was supposed to go to Brazil. The point is that Pearl Harbor occurred during the end of the shooting of Magnificent Ambersons, and immediately America declared war, and everybody wanted to contribute to the war effort, not least Welles himself.
So, okay, well, that all makes sense, but then he started getting reports that the editing of The Magnificent Ambersons was not going well. It was being ruined, and you would think any sensible person would rush back to Hollywood and try to defend his film to save it, but he didn't do that.
No. What happened is that Welles and his editor, Robert Wise, who later, of course, became a famous film director of The Sound of Music, amongst other things, Robert Wise and Welles had agreed on more or less a cut of the film, and that is more or less what was shown at the first preview of the film in a town called Pomona in California. Let me just stress as an important contrast between the way Citizen Kane and Magnificent Ambersons were handled that Citizen Kane was never subjected to previews. It was subjected, as I said, to the private viewings of journalists, who then wrote very nicely about it. But it was never exposed to the general public. And if it had been exposed to the general public, I dare say the reactions would have been very much like the reactions to The Magnificent Ambersons. However, with this additional factor, that, of course, America was at war. And here was a film that Welles had chosen and Schaefer had chosen to be as uncontroversial as possible. They didn't want another Citizen Kane. They didn't want another political film. So they chose this magnificent novel by Booth Tarkington, this grand novel of Midwest life, in Indiana life, and it depicts the decline of American gentry and the lamentable rise of industrialization. Well, put that in front of a preview audience, basically of university kids, shortly after America has joined in the Second World War, and you can expect exactly what happened, which is that they absolutely despised it. Especially it was on a double bill with another film about America going to war, a very exuberant film about America going to war, and a personal appearance by James Cagney. Now, they were all for James Cagney, they were all for the war film, and, of course, they despised and detested The Magnificent Ambersons. RKO got incredibly panicked and said, we've got to cut it because it's too long, but also we've got to lighten it up and brighten it up. We can't have all this somberness. And amazingly enough, a lot of Welles' collaborators agreed with them. Joseph Cotten, who's not only, you know, acted with Welles, but was Welles' best friend, nominally, and the guy who ran Welles' office, Jack Moss, and various others all said, and Schaefer said, yes, it's right. It's too dark. And so then they started the process, the catastrophic process of cutting it and of reshooting it and rescoring it. And Welles was kept apprised of all of this, but as you say, it is really astonishing that he didn't just say, okay, I'm getting on the next plane out.
So why didn't he?
I think that he simply believed that in some weird way he was protected. You know, that his star would not be extinguished. I think Kane might have given him a certain feeling. Lots of people think that Caine daunted Wells, that he could never repeat it. I disagree. What I think is that Wells felt omnipotent as a result of Caine, because not only had it been acclaimed absolutely universally, but he defeated William Randolph Hearst. The fact that it did no business didn't matter to Wells at all, because money, you know, meant nothing. Wells had no concept at all of money. All he knew was that it was a huge, triumphant success. And I think he thought, oh, they couldn't really do damage to this from me, the director of Citizen Caine. I think there was that in the back of his mind. But when they started giving him absolute details about what they were cutting, he kept saying, I don't think any of this is right. And this, I think, is what you should cut. And frankly, one isn't exactly impressed by the things that Wells wanted to cut either. Mm. He seemed to want to cut some of the best things in the movie. It just points to the fact that you can't possibly edit a film by remote control.
Well, you get the sense that in some ways the final product may not have mattered to him so much. I mean, the joy he took, the creative energy he got was in the making of the movie itself. I mean, really the shooting of the movie. And maybe I'm reading too much into this, but it's almost as if polishing it, turning it into a gem, was not the most important thing for him in the end.
That became increasingly so. I think that that's something that developed more as the years went by, especially in his last, say, 20 years. I think he became purely an experimental filmmaker, and he'd do one of those commercials for Paul Masson in order to hire a camera, a group of actors, a studio for a week or so, and shoot a bit of a movie, just to see what it would be like. And I honour him for that. I think that's fascinating. He becomes to me like an alchemist in his laboratory, just testing things out, trying things out. And it was his lament from the moment he went to Hollywood that experiment was impossible in Hollywood. Nobody would allow you to explore the medium. And that's what he did, really. He, in the end, devoted his life to exploring the medium. What we make of his explorations or his experiments is another matter. But the fact that he did that, he engaged in that activity, I find quite exhilarating.
Actor Simon Callow. He's the author of Orson Welles Volume 2, Hello Americans. He spoke with Steve Paulson.